Now we call the president dude. There's no distinction between above, below, those higher than you. Adults feel awkward correcting other people's children. Sons and daughters don't say yes sir, no ma'am. Grandparents don't discipline because they don't want to be the bad guy. Children were to be seen and not heard in once upon a time, and now that child-centered homes, child-centered schools, there's no winner, there's no loser, there's no better, there's no worse, there's no higher, there's no lower. Every kid gets a trophy. On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we're talking about the loss of authority as we conclude our series on recovering the lost tools of discipleship.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We are in part five of our five-part series on recovering the lost tools of discipleship. Lining Boston streets in 1776 were signs defying the authority of King George. They read, "We serve no sovereigns here." In that context, of course, the question was about the colonists' relationship to an earthly monarch across the sea. It was this disdain for tyranny and love for the rule of law rather than the rule of men that launched the American experiment. Soon, however, the drive for individual liberty flooded the proper boundaries of politics. In the Great Awakening, the individual was often sovereign over the church as well. What's more, with the Second Great Awakening, even God's sovereignty was made subordinate to the free will of the autonomous individual. We elected our deity, not just our president. Experience on the frontier taught our forebears that they had to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, not only in building their cabin in the woods, but in their relationship with God. In his famous essay, Self-Reliance, Ralph Waldo Emerson showed himself a faithful high priest of the distinctly American religion. Many came from the old world as persecuted sects, others as immigrants who sought to preserve their creeds and confessions. Others arrived with dreams of becoming their own prophets, founding entirely new religions. Before long, however, none could apparently resist the pressure to conform their faith and practice to the logic of personal free will and ecclesiastical free enterprise. "We serve no sovereigns here" came to mean something far more sweeping than anything that the Bostonian revolutionaries had in mind. As we finish off our miniseries on recovering the lost tools of discipleship, we'll be tackling this penchant we've inherited from Adam and fine-tuned in our culture to make of ourselves our own prophets, priests, and kings. And to discuss this topic, we have your usual hosts, Rod Rosenblatt, professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine, Kim Riddlebarger, the pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California, Ken Jones, the pastor of Glendale Baptist Church in Miami, Florida, and I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. Gentlemen, first of all, how important is it that we distinguish between things heavenly and things earthly here? We're talking about freedom, freedom from sovereigns, no sovereigns here, as a political statement in Boston in 1775, but how has that become part of our character, that, where we even raise it to the King of Heaven?
Well, Americans hate kings, and that has carried over into American culture in all different kinds of ways. Americans love Invictus, that poem, "I'm the master of my fate and the captain of my soul." We have the rugged individualism, which is part of American culture. And I don't want to depreciate that, because as you say, Mike, if you distinguish things earthly from things heavenly, then you can see in America the winning of world wars and the landing of men on the moon and things that come from that stress on individuals seeking to pursue good things for good ends.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In that kingdom, a wonderful thing, as opposed to, say, the collective.
Well, yeah. Exactly.
But I think that idea of a desire for absolute freedom, it goes back to the garden.
Yep.
I mean,
that's
where it begins. And so even though it manifests itself in particular cultures in a particular way, it is native to Adam. I mean, that was part of the fall,
sure.
rebelling against mm-hmm. the authority of God.
And turning within to find that inner
exactly.
light. Alexis de Tocqueville, the French commentator, when he came to America just after the War of Independence, traveled around and collected his thoughts, and he said one of the distinguishing characteristics of the American character is that they don't need books. Because he says they have found the truth within themselves. And that really comes all the way down to Oprah and to where we are today, where there's a kind of egalitarianism, isn't there, that says, basically, I don't respect people who have studied something, made it their life goal to sort of be a master of that subject. My opinion weighs just as heavily as theirs.
Exactly.
I don't have to respect my elders. I don't have to respect my pastor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to respect my parents. Really interesting how Paul wraps all that together when he warns Timothy, in the last days, men will be lovers of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if these are bullet points under that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They will be disobedient to parents. They will disrespect authority. They will be rebellious.
Lovers of money.
Lovers of money.
Pleasure.
Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. It all starts really with God. You know, if we say no sovereigns here at the top of the universe, then mm-hmm. that means really there is no proper hierarchy. There is
right.
no
right.
sense of higher, lower, moving from here to there. We're all basically level.
Mm-hmm.
And God is one of the players among other players, and we elect him just like we elect our city commissioner.
Well, and that's where the most secular branch of the Enlightenment, that was their premise. That was their platform. They, in claiming human independence, it wasn't just from the crown. It was from any outside authority other than self.
Yeah, right.
It's Immanuel Kant, the spirit
exactly.
of the Enlightenment. And
exactly.
you read through Kant's essay, and Kant
sure.
uses one of his foils, the Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church, for mm-hmm. being authoritarian.
Yeah. Now, a while back, a Time magazine cover story posed the big question, what really matters? The author, Robert Rosenblatt, no relation to the better-known Rod Rosenblatt, sought to define the idea characterizing our age. His answer? It's the determination to break away not only from certain norms, but eventually from any constraints at all. The basis of this self-determination, he said, is the assumption that what was not free ought to be free, that limits were intrinsically evil. He calls it our age of self-confident autonomy. But he notes wisely, when people are unfettered, they are freed, but not yet free. That's Time magazine.
Wow.
What's really interesting there, and you see it in the culture, in a lot of the debates that are, you know, around there today, basically, it's not that we should be free for this because this is a value. This is true,
uh-huh.
good, and beautiful.
Right.
But just freedom and anything that threatens that freedom, I'm going to test it, even to the point of saying, for example, that I should be able to marry whomever or whatever I want
Absolutely.
To marry.
Sure.
My choice is sovereign, and you better not run over that.
Yeah,
yeah exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Years ago, in one of my favorite coffee shops, there was this picture hanging on the wall with this poem. I have taken the pill. I have hoisted my skirts to my thighs, dropped them to my ankles, rebelled at the university, skied at Aspen, lived with two men, married one, earned my keep, kept my identity, and frankly, I'm lost. That sort of expresses this idea characterizing our age that Robert Rosenblatt talks about.
It's the modern Invictus, you know, just fleshed out a little bit more. I'm the master of my fate, the captain of my soul, and by the time I get where I'm going, I'm lost.
You know,
I've
heard very few people make that conclusion, though.
Right.
Very few.
Everything else. But that's what I like about it. There's a sense of irony, a sense of, I get it. I realize that when you're unfettered, you're freed, but not necessarily free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
An article I quoted bits of a while back, Harper's, Hot Air Gods. Curtis White describes, the situation pretty well. He says, when we assert, this is my belief, We're invoking our right to have our private conviction, no matter how ridiculous, not only tolerated politically, but respected by others. It says, look, I've invested a lot of emotional energy in this belief, and in a way, I've staked the credibility of my life on it. So if you ridicule it, you can expect a fight. Mm. And I hear that a lot in the culture wars from evangelical Christians.
You know, you better not.
And you can understand why people then come back and say, for instance, in the gay lobby, basically the same thing.
Sure.
This is my experience. This is my life. Leave me alone. Mm-hmm. And this
you have no right to critique.
Yeah,
right, because it's mine.
Right. Regardless of the political freedoms you should or shouldn't have, you have no right to critique, to even have a view about this.
And the purpose of the state is to enforce the fact that no one else has a right to critique your position.
Right. And we do the same thing on the other side. This is what we've come to in our dialogue in this country right now. Basically, I have my beliefs that I've invested a lot of emotional and moral energy in, and back off instead of having an argument and saying, well, you know, is it possible here that there's some truth that transcends your inner hunch?
Yeah. Mm.
He goes on to say, and again, this is Harper's. This isn't Christianity Today. What we require of belief is not that it makes sense, but that it be sincere. This is so even for more secular convictions. Clearly, this is not the spirituality of centralized orthodoxy, sort of a workshop spirituality that you can get with a cereal box top and $5. And yet in our culture, to suggest that such belief is not deserving of respect makes people anxious. An anxiety that expresses itself in the desperate sincerity with which we deliver life's little lessons. There is an obvious problem with this form of spirituality. It takes place in isolation. When the political freedom of religion has been broadened to the dogma that everyone is free to believe whatever she likes, there is no real shared conviction at all, and hence no church and certainly no community. Strangely, our freedom to believe has achieved the condition that Nietzsche called nihilism, by a route he never imagined. While European nihilism just denied God, American nihilism is something very different. Our nihilism is our capacity to believe in everything and anything all at once. It's all good. And that's really a good way of summarizing where this subjective narcissism leads.
Well, I've put it this way in terms of the worship wars. You have two camps here. One debate is between the normative versus the regulative principles of worship. But in that camp, the debate is what is authorized or commanded in the scriptures. So it's really what you understand the scriptures to teach. In the other camp, it's between the contemporary and the traditional modes of worship. The issue there is not what you think the scriptures teach, but what do you feel most comfortable with.
Yeah.
And
what works for you.
Exactly. So one is attempting to let scripture be the authoritative voice. And in the other one, this is why so many churches can have traditional worship and contemporary, because it's now a matter of personal preference.
Yeah, it's a flavor. It's a style. This is interesting. Shane, our producer, gave us this tidbit from the School of Manners. This was used in American schools throughout the 1700s. And I'm quoting this just to show the difference between life in sort of pre-egalitarian America and the way that we're doing things today. Love, fear, and serve God. Honor the king. Reverence thy parents. Submit to thy superiors. Be courteous with thy equals. Hearken to instruction. Be desirous of learning, study virtue, please thy master, restrain thy tongue, let not play entice thee. At church, fix thine eye upon the minister, let it not wildly wander to gaze upon any person or thing.
Wow.
Attend diligently to the words of the minister, pray with him when he prayeth, and while he prayeth, listen that thou mayest remember. At school, be humble, submissive, and obedient to those whose authority by nature or providence hath a just claim to your subjection. Be always respectful, never bold. let your body on every occasion be pliable and ready to manifest the inward reverence you bear towards those above you. Wow, even to talk about those above you today. And then now we call the president dude. There's no distinction between above, below, those higher than you, or even a form of culture. You know, there's no highbrow or lowbrow.
It's been said that one of the keys to the presidential election is for the president to appear on Jay Leno or David Letterman.
Sons and daughters don't say yes sir, no ma'am. They call their teacher Pam instead of Mrs. Johnson. Adults feel awkward correcting other people's children, whereas in earlier days, you know, an adult would walk in the room and would feel perfectly justified, and other parents would say, thank you. Yeah. There's kind of a community thing here.
Yep. Not anymore.
Grandparents don't discipline because they don't want to be the bad guy.
We're spending our children's inheritance.
Yeah, their bumper sticker.
Yes.
You know, children were to be seen and not heard in once upon a time, and now that child-centered homes, child-centered schools, good grief, 100 years of John Dewey has given us this, the little darlings. Corporal punishment is always wrong, if not child abuse today. Mm-hmm. Every kid gets a trophy. You don't want to crush their self-esteem. Every kid... There's no winner, there's no loser, there's no better, there's no worse, there's no higher, there's no lower. Everybody gets a trophy.
Trust me, the kids know who won and lost.
Yeah,
right.
They keep
score. Right. Fathers are no longer viewed as the head of the house in a home where there are fathers. Mm-hmm. Now the children have an equal place with the mom and the dad. Everybody's equal here.
Goodness.
Here's an ad in the American Way magazine. No matter where you've been or where you're going, the NIV Life Journey Bible was created to meet you right where you are. It's filled with 300 relevant notes, as opposed to
the text,
the 8 gazillion irrelevant verses. Yeah. It's filled with 300 relevant notes and other features, goodness. Each written to connect the Bible to any point of your journey.
Because the author of the Bible didn't think of you or your journey.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. It was indifferent to that.
And, by the way, your journey is all God thinks about.
Yeah.
He is just so upset. He gets up every morning wondering about your journey.
In 300 ways. He'll tell you all about it.
Yeah. He just revolves around you and your journey. When you read this ad, it strikes you that this is not a book I'm called to submit to. This is a book that I'm called to use for whatever benefit I find useful in my life.
Yep. Yeah. Or not.
Or not. Exactly. And once I've used it, I'm free to put it away and find something else I can use.
Yeah. Boy, you think of Judges 17:6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes.
Here we are again.
Yeah. It's we're all a bunch of Adams and Eves saying, I think whatever gods that be for my immortal soul, I am the master of my fate, the captain of my soul.
Mm-hmm. I've often said the theme song of hell is I did it my way.
Yeah.
And continue to do so.
Yeah. I quoted Alexis de Tocqueville earlier. This is another quote from him in Democracy in America. He says, to escape from imposed systems and to seek by themselves and in themselves for the only reason for things, Americans look to results without getting entangled in the means toward them. So each man is narrowly shut up in himself, and from that basis makes the pretension to judge the world.
Man, he was sharp. Huh?
Really?
Boy,
amazing.
Did he get the greatness and the weakness of the American character?
Boy, did he.
Well, and you have people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, in his Harvard Divinity School address, saying whatever hold religion had on us is gone or going. We have to basically find the truth within ourselves.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that ever since. Walt Whitman's Song of Myself.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
This is American Romanticism that played itself out in spades in the Second Great Awakening and in evangelicalism ever since.
Yeah, there's no real problem with the loss of any transcendence or any divine word from heaven if all of it's in you and trumps that word anyway, what's the problem?
Yeah. Well, right. And if you go back even before the Second Great Awakening, look at the aftermath of the First Great Awakening, where you had the inner light controversy. And that was where the personal subjective experience became the means by which you determine whether or not a religious or if your faith was a legitimate faith.
If there's true mm-hmm. conversion.
Yes.
Yeah. Historians make this point all over the place. Certainly Nathan Hatch in his book, The Democratization of American Christianity, that it's not just that Protestants in America were shaped by a culture of individualism and pragmatism and romanticism, but that actually many of these cultural characteristics were created by American revivalism.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as Puritanism decayed, this is the typical narrative. You know, Puritanism, with its serious view of God, human beings, sin, fall, redemption, a more pragmatic view came in, emphasis on free will and Arminianism. One of those trajectories went in the direction of Unitarianism,
yep.
liberalism,
yep.
and another went in the direction of Charles Finney and mm-hmm. revivalistic Pelagianism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But both at root are Pelagian.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And in their own way, liberalism and fundamentalism killed whatever Reformation heritage mm-hmm. there once was.
Yeah. George Marsden's Fundamentalism in American Culture is stellar on that point.
Yes.
It really is good. I would encourage anybody who grew up in evangelicalism to read that, along with Hatch's book. Those two are must-reads for anybody who's interested in this stuff.
And Daryl Hart's Old Time
yes.
Religion.
Yeah, yeah.
He makes that point, because I think what gets lost in that discussion is the part played by the First Great Awakening, which is really the beginning of the end of the Puritanism in the pre-colonial days.
Yeah.
That's where the centrality of doctrine and church begins to disintegrate, and it becomes a subjective, almost a purely subjective experience that launches or validates one's religious claims.
Yeah, even in that First Great Awakening, you had preachers burning their ministerial gowns and books, their libraries, in a couple of cases. Not going to have any book learning.
Yeah.
This is the Holy Spirit speaking to me. I come to the garden alone while mm-hmm. the dew is still on the roses, and mm-hmm. he walks with me and talks with me and tells me I'm his own. And the joy we share
yes,
as we tarry there.
Yeah.
None other has ever known. Well, then I don't have to read anybody else.
Exactly.
I have this experience.
Yeah, I'm done. That's it.
Well, and you had students at the time, divinity students that were expelled, including David Brainerd, because they were evaluating the spirituality of their professors against the personalities of the revivalists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
The fervency of their prayers rather than the content of their prayers.
Yeah. It goes back that far. You think of the Apostle Paul all over the place telling us a major command throughout Paul's exhortations. Grow up. That's a summary of all sorts of exhortations he gives.
Yeah.
He keeps telling people, grow up.
Yeah.
Go on to maturity.
Yep.
Stop being a baby.
Yeah.
And yet in our culture, it's stay forever young.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Delaying adulthood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ideal in the past was for children to grow up through different stages and look forward to being an adult. Now adults are trying to be children again.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. You think of young boys who were able, if necessary, to handle the family farm when they were 12.
Mm. Yeah. Or go to university when they were 12.
Yeah. They had an idea of what they were there for and from whom they got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, that's painting with a broad brush.
Right.
But compared
right.
to our generation, mm-hmm. it's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're mid-20s, and I don't know what to do with my life.
Right.
There's a great article by Joseph Epstein in the Weekly Standard, The Kindergarky. I love that. This is
nice turn of phrase.
Yeah, here are some great quotes. In America, we are currently living in a kindergarky under rule by children. Children have gone from background to foreground figures in domestic life with more and more attention centered on them, their upbringing, their small accomplishments, their right relationship with parents and grandparents. For the last 30 years at least, we've been lavishing vast expense and anxiety on our children in ways that are unprecedented in America and perhaps any other nation's life. Such has been the weight of all this concern about children that it has exercised a subtle but pervasive tyranny of its own. This is what I call kindergarten. Dreary, boring, sadly misguided kindergarten. One of the direct results of the 1960s was that the culture put a new premium on youthfulness. Adulthood, as it had hitherto been perceived, was on the way out, beginning with clothes and ending with personal conduct. Everyone, even people with children and other adult responsibilities, wanted to continue to think of himself as still young, often well into his 40s and 50s. One of the consequences of this was that one shied away from the old parental role of authority figure, mm-hmm. dealing out rewards and punishments and passing on knowledge somewhat distant, carefully rationing out intimacy, establishing one's solidity and strength. Suddenly, parents wanted their children to think of them as, if not exactly contemporaries, then as friends, pals, fun people. Parents of my own parents' generation may have been more or less kind, generous, humorous, warm, but however attractive, they never thought of themselves as their children's friends. When your son becomes a man, or your daughter a woman, make him or her your brother or sister, an old Arab proverb has it. But it's probably a serious mistake to make that kid of 9 or 14 your brother or sister.
Yeah. Wow.
Children are best seen, not heard. That was a maxim once in frequent use. Speak only when spoken to, was another piece of advice regularly issued to children. Now kids are encouraged to come forth as soon and as frequently as they wish to demonstrate their brightness, cuteness, creativity. On visits to the homes of friends with small children, one finds their toys strewn everywhere, their drawings on the refrigerator, television sets turned to their shows. Parents in this context seem less than secondary, little more than indentured servants. Under the kindergarten, all arrangements are centered on children, their schooling, their lessons, their predilections, their care and feeding, and general high maintenance. Children are the name of the game. No other generations of kids have been so curried and cultivated. And it just goes on and on. It really does hit the solar plexus
sure does.
Of my generation.
It sure does.
Oh, we see it so much. And even in our churches, you look at how the parents have curtailed their calendar to accommodate all of the extracurriculars of the children. So they're no longer able to come to Bible study. Well, because so-and-so.
And soccer like practice.
Soccer practice. Even worship time has been co-opted by soccer schedules.
I hear it all the time.
And I just think, you know, of children not of being seen and not heard. When I was growing up, if adults were talking in a room and you paused for too long, you were in that room, the conversation would stop. Excuse me, what are you doing in here?
Right.
You have no place in here. This is an adult conversation.
It's not an accident, Mike, that our parents' generation was called the greatest generation. And there's a reason why they were the greatest generation, because they all lived through the Great Depression.
Suffering.
And anybody who was the generation of my mom and dad would tell you that as hard as it was, the best time that they had as a family was during the Depression. That everything mattered. Every little thing counted for something. And there was the genuine sense that if we don't pull together, you know, we're going to lose everything. That I think was left an indelible mark, that suffering really, really prepared the greatest generation. The second thing I think that jumps out at this is the point that we've lost any sense of the distinction between high culture and folk culture. So now everything is pop culture.
Yeah.
That's the point that T. David Gordon makes in his book, Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, the point that we have lost the distinction between high culture and low culture and mid-culture. Yes, exactly. So there is no sense of reverence. There's no sense of respect. There are no outer rings that stem from our folk culture.
When you think about these wider cultural trends that people like Epstein are talking about here, it really makes sense when we look around at the church, that the church has become playground.
Well, and that's tough because the church just reeks authority. I mean, Scripture.
Hierarchy.
Yeah, Scripture tells us what we must think and do from God himself.
Mm-hmm.
The church is his, the called out ones, the assembly of his people to hear his word and to organize themselves around, you know, local authorities, a minister and elders, a liturgy that tells us,
sure,
you know, what God wants to say to us that particular time. He's going to speak, and we need to prepare ourselves. It just goes against the grain of everything in that essay.
I imagine, this is just from the hip, but I imagine that there's going to be a proportion of those kids who are yearning,
yeah,
for some sort of hierarchy that reflects how things really are.
Yeah.
That'll be a percentage.
That's why a lot of evangelicals are going Roman.
Yeah, yeah. But if they long, yeah, for within them after all of this stuff,
yeah,
to say, is there hierarchy anywhere,
yeah,
and can I know anything about it?
Yeah, I think that's true, Rod. I remember when I was living in Lake Tahoe as a kid, one of my buddies was a hippie kid, and he spent a lot of time over at my house.
Mm-hmm.
And he started calling my parents Mom and Dad. What I found interesting is when I went to his house, which he didn't want to spend very much time at, his parents, he didn't call Mom and Dad. He called them by their first names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was interesting when the two families got together for dinner, how different they were. And
yeah,
with his mom and dad offering my parents
a hit
yeah, from their weed. And
yeah,
it was interesting to see them take it. But no, they didn't. But, you know, a lot of kids are yearning, just
yes,
as you,
yeah,
say, Rod. They're,
yes,
they're yearning for that because it says, look, you care about me.
Yes.
You're not coddling me.
Right.
Well, but you care,
well,
about me.
I had a similar experience in college. It was a kid who lived in the dorms. His stepfather was a big movie producer or something. They lived 3 miles away from the campus, but he lived on campus. And whenever it was a holiday weekend or something, he would rather go with me to the inner city of L.A. to our home,
uh-huh,
than 3 miles down the road
in Malibu
to his palatial estate that overlooked the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, see, that there's a there. And
yeah,
the problem is,
yeah,
there's a lot of drifting that just doesn't, you know, when you think of the fact that so many, this doesn't explain everything, but so many of us, myself included, were part of the public school system. Yeah, I'm a victim,
mm-hmm,
of this child-centered approach that modern education got from John Dewey and
mm-hmm,
other,
yep,
theorists. Mm-hmm. John Dewey said, I mean, he's the creator of this whole idea of the school as the nursery for democratic social reform.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for expression.
Yes. And the school is going to create a truly democratic, egalitarian society.
Yep.
Woodrow Wilson said the primary job of an educator was to make a child as unlike his father as possible.
Oh, are you, goodness, serious?
Well, yeah, it had to be, yeah, sarcasm.
No. Wow. No. That was the purpose of education. To make these children as unlike their parents as possible because the parents were not anywhere near ready to face the modern world that youth needed to be.
There's
that's
that
another,
idea of better.
I already
and
hated
better.
Wilson. You've just given me another one as to why I hate Wilson. Goodness,
yeah,
gracious.
The goal is not to learn facts, but to learn how to live, to realize, mm, one's full potential,
yep,
and to improve society. He writes,
goodness,
in Democracy and Education, John Dewey writes, this was 1916, the adjustment of individual activity on the basis of this social consciousness is the only sure method of social reconstruction.
Yeah.
The focus should not be on the curriculum, but on the child.
Gosh. Mm.
We need to rid ourselves of the older idea that the child is simply the immature being who is to be matured. He is the superficial being who is to be deepened. They need to root their learning in their own experience. It is experiential learning that we need. Teachers are not the ones standing up front giving knowledge. They are facilitators and guides. And then in his My Pedagogical Creed, 1897, he argues, the teacher is not in the school to impose certain ideas or to form certain habits in the child, but is there as a member of the community to select the influences which shall affect the child and to assist him in properly responding to these influences. Now, I read that. Then I read Tony Jones, one of the emergent church leaders, describing the service at Duck Paget's church that he's a part of. in an emergent church service, what you find is that there is no sermon with some special clergy person up front preaching this message. Rather, we sit in a circle, and he doesn't just say that the minister, he says the Bible is now seen as a member of the community, a participant in the conversation. You talk about leveling. Not only do you not have a minister who knows more than you,
yeah,
and who basically says, I'm the shepherd under Christ.
Yeah.
You're the sheep.
Yeah.
You need to learn this.
Yeah.
But rather, you don't even have the Bible itself as authoritative.
Right.
You can't have one thing over another, over the individual precious self anymore.
Again, this is from the hip. Those people who grow up in that sort of world, and it continues all the way through college, I think are a setup for a totalitarian leader.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, that's
a setup.
Statism is just underneath that.
Yeah.
But on the religious end, that's why so many former church members end up in cults. Not just Rome. They end up in cults.
Yeah. And for example, George Barna, the evangelical church marketing leader, he says, we have to realize the first principle of Christian communication is this: the audience, not the message, is sovereign.
Yeah.
Boy, that's right out of John Dewey. But it's also kind of the culture in which we've been immersed. And we've got to get to the place where we say the greatest danger in the church today is not one particular heresy.
Right.
The greatest danger in the church today is, given the situation that we've all been raised in, and the cultural captivity that we all take for granted so much we don't even know we're captive to it,
right,
is making it so that there is no such thing as truth or heresy to talk about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, this is why, folks, we've got to recover the lost tools of discipleship. We've got to recover thinking well, arguing well, examining, discerning, wisely and prudently unpacking things, not responding in a knee-jerk emotional kind of way.
And not as nihilists.
Right. Yeah. We believe that there is a reality out there.
Yeah.
And that the greatest decisions I have to make today are not which song to listen to on my iPod.
Right.
Big stuff, folks. And we have, as Christians, we believe that the biggest issues are eternal issues. And that right away hits a lot of these right on the head. Number one, it says that there is, after all, universal truth, not just my subjective hunches.
Right, and I can align with it or dump it.
Right, but we will all appear before the judgment seat of Christ.
Absolutely.
And it also says that there's something more important than my subjective personal experience.
Yep.
And if that's true, we need to invest time and energy in recovering these lost tools of discipleship in our lives, in our homes.
And for our children's sake.
For our children's sake and in our churches.
Amen.
Well, we'll look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.